This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Universalist Tim DeChristopher committed an act which would redefine patriotism in our time. Follow Tim, bitter 70, from college student to incarcerated felon. He bid millions of dollars he didn't have to save thousands of pristine acres of land surrounding U.S. national parks. KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of this film screening. More information can be found at kboo.fm/bitter70film2013.
This Friday is International Women's Day, and KBOO will celebrate the occasion with a 35-hour extravaganza of music, interviews, and news produced and hosted by KBOO Women. We'll kick off this special day of programming on Thursday, March 7th at 7 p.m. with a live broadcast panel on the history of Portland's women's movement. And the all-women broadcast will continue until 6 a.m. on Saturday. For a full schedule, see the website kboo.fm/womensday2013.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council hears another round of public testimony on a proposed city sick leave ordinance.
The U.S. Senate approves the nomination of John Brennan as head of the CIA.
And the state of Arkansas adopts the most restrictive abortion law in the nation.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 7th, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Portland City Council is currently in the midst of a three-hour block of public testimony on a proposed city mandate on employee sick leave. The session, which began at 3 p.m., is the second session of public comment on the legislation, which was introduced by City Commissioner Amanda Fritz earlier this year. The first round of public comment drew dozens of testimonies from proponents and critics of the bill. As it stands now, the ordinance would require Portland private employers to give employees who work at least 240 hours a year up to 40 hours a year of sick leave. This amounts to allowing employees to earn 1 hour of leave per 30 hours of work. For employers of six or more people, paid sick leave is required, whereas employers with fewer employees can choose unpaid time off as an alternative. Over the past month, a task force on the topic made a few changes. Now, employees would have to wait 3 months to use sick leave, as opposed to the previously proposed month and a half. Collective bargaining provisions have also been removed from the ordinance. KBOO reporter Jamie Partridge was on the scene at City Hall this afternoon and spoke with community members there for their opinions on the push for mandatory sick leave.
I'm talking with Dan Clay, who's the president of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. Dan, why are all these folks in yellow t-shirts of your union here today?
Well, we have members from all over the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington showing up to support first day sick pay in Portland. We believe it's important because we work with the public's food.
Now, your members have a union contract that guarantees them some earned sick leave. Is that correct?
That is correct. The union contract guarantees sick pay, but doesn't allow them to take it until the third day, which means a lot of members have a choice between going to work sick or not being able to pay their rent. It makes sense that every worker should have the opportunity to heal, and society shouldn't have to come face-to-face with somebody who's sick and shouldn't be working.
Talking with Lee Mercer with the Main Street Alliance of Oregon, who is here in support of paid sick leave. Why is the Main Street Alliance in support of paid sick leave?
Well, there's several reasons. One, it's the right thing to do. A lot of the small businesses we work with treat their employees like family, and they feel like they want to give them all the benefits they can. At the same time, a lot of kind of cost-benefit analysis. We did a study with the Voice Alliance, another Portland Business Alliance, and the report we put out, basically, the numbers around the country indicate that with all the benefits of providing sick leave, lower turnover, the various actual dollar benefits for employers, it's actually cheaper to provide sick leave than not to provide. And so there's a business argument for providing it. Some groups are arguing that the business community didn't have a chance to speak out on this. That's not actually correct. We've been talking with business owners around Portland since last spring. Several of the groups that are represented that are kind of against it were informed of it in maybe July of last year. This conversation's been going on with the city council. There was a whole process of meetings of business owners, business organizations, city council members, labor people that crafted the original bill. So it's a little disingenuous to say that business hasn't been involved, because we have been for quite a while.
That was KBOO's Jamie Partridge speaking with Dan Clay, president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and Lee Mercer with the Main Street Alliance of Oregon, outside of City Hall this afternoon about the proposed sick leave mandate. Inside, advocates, business leaders, and members of the public voiced both support and criticism of the proposed ordinance. Here are some of their words, beginning with Bernie Bottomley of the Portland Business Alliance.
We still have significant concerns about the ordinance and about the process. Legislation is always sausage making, but when you rush, odd things can get into the meat. We'd like to see this process go slower and be more inclusive. The task force did a good job, but I'm still talking to folks in the community who are just now coming to grips with the fact that this is moving forward and have had just not enough time to really absorb all of the nuances and issues involved with it. So we have concern about the process. We have concern about the city's role in whether this is truly an appropriate role for the city to be in employer-employee relations. When an elected and a political body substitutes its judgment for what's good for the economy, for the business community's judgment and the employees' judgment, it's a very slippery slope, and it can result in attempts to have a one-size-fits-all approach, which doesn't fit a lot of people.
Mayor Hales and members of the City Council, my name is Andrea Peluso. I represent Family Forward Oregon and the Family Forward Education Fund. The ordinance before you today is not only about employers' bottom lines, though it doesn't discount the importance of those either. It is about multiple bottom lines, those of workers struggling to make ends meet and those of employers who are working to do the right thing in a free market that discourages it. It is about the community's bottom line with disease spreads and healthcare costs increase. It is also about public health and social justice and equity. I'm happy to submit for your review. It's being passed around a cost-benefit analysis conducted by the Institute for Women's Policy Research that looks at this specific Portland policy and estimates that, based on utilization of sick time estimated through use of the National Health Interview Survey, adding in the sick time required by this act will increase employer costs by 19 cents per hour for employees receiving new leave, which constitutes $6.90 per week. However, these costs will be offset by 24 cents per hour or $9 per week reduction in costs related to the current loss of productivity and increased spread of disease that results from presenteeism for an overall net savings. Additionally, this report estimates nearly $18 million in community savings that we can anticipate from the reduced spread of disease, reduced urgent care and emergency room visits, and nursing home stays. That report is public today and available for review. I thank you for your ongoing and thorough consideration of this ordinance, and I urge you to pass this ordinance, this version of this ordinance, next week. Thank you.
Those were some of the testifiers present at today's City Council hearing on a proposed city sick leave ordinance. The contentiously debated ordinance is set for a final City Council vote next week.
The City of Portland is holding several public budget forums to discuss the impact of planned cuts to the city's budget. The next forum will be this coming Tuesday, March 12th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at George Middle School, at 10,000 North Burr, that's B-U-R-R, Avenue in Portland. Many local programs are designated to be cut from this year's budget in an effort to accommodate a projected $20 million deficit. The new mayor, Charlie Hales, asked all city bureaus to submit revised budgets to him reflecting 10% cuts. but some groups are hoping to have their programs added back into the final budget. One of the projects slated to be cut is the Neighborhood Small Grants Program that has funded over 500 community building grants since it began 7 years ago. Neighborhood associations will lose funding for publications, and neighborhood outreach programs will also be cut. This means fewer city-sponsored community projects like cleanups, summertime events, and community forums. And reductions in the neighborhood crime prevention program will mean laying off 2 crime prevention specialists. 3 more budget forums are scheduled over the next 2 months. This Tuesday in North Portland, on April 11th in the northwest of Portland, and on May 16th at City Hall.
A committee of the Oregon Senate held a hearing today on a bill that would change the structure of Oregon's public universities. The Education Committee also heard a proposal supported by State Treasurer Ted Wheeler to authorize the sale of up to $5 million in bonds to create an endowed fund for higher education. That measure is supported by Oregon bankers and businesses, who will likely be the ones to hold most of the bonds. The Oregon Bankers Association and other supporters offered free pizza to students who would show up at a pro-bond measure rally held at the state capitol today. Very few students took them up on the offer. Here's a clip of some of the testimony at today's hearing.
The Opportunity Initiative is not a panacea. This is not the solution to how we reach these lofty goals, but it's an important part of it. It is not without risk, but I think by passing these bills, what ultimately the legislature is saying is there is no idea that is too big for Oregon. This is one that would make a statement, not only nationally, but globally, in terms of our commitment to higher education and our commitment to our economy and the financial security of our citizens.
As I read the bill, there's potential that at some point in time, the legislature would have the ability to borrow from what we have borrowed. Am I wrong on that as I read it? I think it's available if we hit a crisis.
What we have done is put the state constitution's most stringent lock upon this fund and allow the legislature to borrow only if there is a repayment plan, only if the governor has declared an emergency, and only if 4/5 of the legislature agree to that. And in any case, the money must be repaid back into the fund.
After today's hearing in the State Education Committee, the bond measure will have 2 additional hearings before it is brought before the full Senate.
Portland police have identified the victim of this year's second fatal police shooting, which took place Sunday at a Lloyd Center parking garage. Santiago Cisneros III was an Iraq War veteran suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Cisneros was one of 3 soldiers who spoke to Seattle television station KOMO in 2009 about their struggles with PTSD. He told reporters that he had tried to kill himself about 8 months after returning from Iraq. Cisneros said in the interview that he knew he was fighting a war when he was in Iraq, but did not expect to have to fight another war with himself when he returned to the United States. Police said Cisneros fired a shotgun at them when they found him on top of a parking lot roof, and they returned fire. Cisneros died later in the hospital. A family friend told the Oregonian that Cisneros battled depression when he returned and that he dramatically changed after his tour in Iraq. Local Iraq War veterans have told KABU in the past that the city lacks the proper resources to address the problem of post-traumatic stress disorder among returning veterans.
A documentary about an environmental activist from Utah will be shown this Friday night at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher was sent to prison for placing the winning bids on parcels of public lands that were going to be sold to the oil and gas industry at an auction in 2008. Those parcels have since been preserved because of his action and remain unavailable for drilling. Michael Wade is one of the organizers of tomorrow's film screening of the movie Bitter 70 about activist Tim DeChristopher.
Economic Justice Action Group and Community for Earth are jointly sponsoring the film with Alliance for Democracy and KBOO Radio. We may just do a brief introduction and, you know, kind of announce that we're going to have a discussion afterwards, because the filmmakers will be linked into us through Skype, and we will be having an interview with them and some Q&A with the filmmakers after the film. The point of the film and the point of this action is we need, as an environmental movement, to improve our tactics and get more direct, because being nice is not Mother Nature's way. She just deals with the facts, and he was dealing with the facts, making a stand, and more of us need to do the same. And that's what I would say about the film.
KBOO News reporter Robin Ryan spoke with the director of the film, Beth Gage, who will be available by video conference for a discussion following tomorrow's film screening.
What is Tim DeChristopher's status now? Where is he?
Tim DeChristopher is on the tail end of his two-year federal prison sentence, and he's in a halfway house in Salt Lake City, Utah. His release date is April 21st. Which is the day before Earth Day, and then he starts 3 years of supervised probation.
Any idea what his plans are once he's released?
Yes. You know, since we're doing a screening of Bitter 70 at the Unitarian Church, it's very fitting that he has recently applied to Harvard Divinity School to become a Unitarian minister.
Can you share with our listeners how he found himself where he is?
He went to a federal oil and gas lease auction being held by the Bureau of Land Management, and he went there to protest it, as many, many other people were doing and many other environmental organizations were doing. And when he went into the building, he was asked if he was there for the auction, and he said, yes, he was. And they said, are you here to be a bidder? And he thought for a second, and he said, why, yes, I am. And he signed the paper, showed them his license, and was given a bidding paddle, and went inside and sat and watched the process, and realized that with the bidding paddle that he'd been given, he could kind of derail this. He could at least maybe make the oil and gas companies pay what they ought to be paying for the land, you know, our public lands that they're drilling on. And later he decided, when he realized, you know, just how sensitive this land was, that perhaps he'd just try and buy it. And he started buying the parcels, even though he knew he didn't have any money to buy the parcels. And so that's what got him into trouble. He, you know, eventually they stopped the auction, interrogated Tim, and then over the process of the next 2.5 years, he was indicted, he was finally tried, sentenced, and sentenced to 2 years in prison.
And you're going to be on hand Friday night through Skype for...
Yes, you know, I hope so. I hope it works. We did a test run, I guess, about a week ago, and it worked, so hopefully we will get to see the people in the audience, and they will get to see us.
What's become of the land parcels that he bid on?
At the end of January, this year, 2013, the 10th Circuit Court finally decided that those parcels will not be auctioned off. There were 77 parcels. Tim won 14 parcels. Of the parcels that were auctioned off that day, 77 of those parcels, most of the parcels, have now been taken off the auction block for the future. So those 77 parcels are safe, and that's really a direct result of Tim stopping that auction. I think if the auction hadn't stopped that day, the parcels that were sold would have been sold. I don't think that it would have been feasible for the Justice Department to take back the parcels once they'd been auctioned off and paid for.
That was filmmaker Beth Gage, who helped create a movie that will screen tomorrow at Portland's First Unitarian Church about a Utah activist who managed to stop the sale of public lands to drilling companies by putting in fraudulent bids at a public auction.
A recently released report by the state of Oregon has found that the state is not prepared for a major earthquake. The Oregon Resilience Plan report declares that Oregon's economy would be impacted for a full decade following a major earthquake if the state continues a business-as-usual approach. The coastal region would be the most heavily impacted both by earthquake damage and by tsunamis created by the earthquake. Estimated recovery times for vital community services in the Willamette Valley in the quake's immediate aftermath include up to 18 months for healthcare facilities in the Portland area and 3 years for hospitals and clinics on the coast. Other vital services, such as electricity or police or fire services, could take 3 to 4 months to recover in Portland and up to 6 months on the coast. And coastal residents could be without water and sewage services for up to 3 years after an earthquake if current practices continue. Study recommendations include more funding for building upgrades, incentives for private developers to earthquake-proof their properties, and updated public policies to allow for longer recovery times. After the 2011 earthquake in Japan, more than 90% of their power supply was restored in 10 days, 90% of the phone lines were working within 2 weeks, and 90% of the cellular base stations were operating in 19 days.
A number of documents recently released to a Toronto conservation group showing a prolonged effort by the Canadian government to build a network of U.S. journalists favorable to the Keystone XL pipeline. The controversial pipeline project would link Canada's oil sands to the Gulf of Mexico, opening up the market for Canadian oil and encouraging the industry's expansion. Climate scientists and activists have fought the Keystone XL pipeline, as well as exploitation of the previously inaccessible tar sands. Since 2011, when protests delayed the U.S. State Department's approval of the pipeline, the Canadian government of Prime Minister Stephen Harper has been reaching out to U.S. journalists, hoping to build a network capable of swaying popular opinion in favor of the pipeline. All of this comes despite dire warnings of what could result from the release of the tar sands estimate 7 gigatons of stored carbon dioxide, a situation noted climate scientist James Hansen calls, quote, game over, end quote, for the environment. The Harper government has been found earlier this year deliberately trying to downplay and discourage research on the negative effects of oil sands activities. A spokesman for the Canadian Embassy in Washington says the outreach efforts were part of a normal advocacy campaign and invokes the future energy and economic security of the U.S. and Canada as a reason to build the pipeline.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa at 6. At 7, tune in for a live remote broadcast from PSU of a panel on the Portland Women's Movement called Building from Activism to Institutions. This marks the beginning of KBOO's special programming in honor of International Women's Day, which will extend tomorrow through Saturday morning at 6 a.m. For more information, visit kboo.fm/womensday2013. Tomorrow's weather will be foggy before 10 a.m., but mostly sunny otherwise, with a high near 52 degrees. Tomorrow night will be mostly cloudy with a low around 34 degrees.
It's 5:25. Well, now it's just about 5:26. It's time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Uh-oh. You always have to worry when you hear that there's, quote, a new air of giddiness on Wall Street. That's a sure sign that financial disaster is looming on our horizon again. After all, giddy is a synonym for feather-brained, frivolous, foolish. This latest outbreak of what was once called irrational exuberance among financial titans has been sparked by a sudden splurge on corporate mergers. In just the past 4 months, a dozen supersized corporate takeovers have siphoned off between $3 billion and $24 billion each in capital, money dumped into frothy deals that create nothing. Why are they done? Follow the money. First, such financial giants as J.P. Morgan Chase constantly push mergers because bankers pocket a fortune in fees for packaging and financing the buyouts. Second, since CEOs have drastically whacked jobs and wages the past few years while also inflating their stock prices, they've now got trillions of dollars in cash they need to move. How about investing in more employees, better service, or improved products? Nah, it's easier and flashier just to buy up competitors, swell their fiefdoms, and get mega kudos for boldness. Third, the biggest private equity buyout firms are also sitting on mountains of cash they accumulated from speculators before the 2008 crash. Hundreds of billions of these speculator dollars, known as dry powder, have to be invested by the end of this year. So the rush is on for them to snap up corporations, whack as many jobs as possible, sell off or shut down segments of the business, then cash in for themselves and the speculators. This is Jim Hightower saying, one Wall Street economist says, giddily, that today's urge to merge is, quote, a sign that corporate America believes that the economic expansion is going to accelerate. Yeah, and run right over us.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
This afternoon, the Senate approved the nomination of John Brennan to lead the Central Intelligence Agency. Brennan's nomination was confirmed by a vote of 63-34. The vote followed a 13-hour talking filibuster by Libertarian Senator Rand Paul. A talking filibuster occurs when a senator or congressmember takes the floor and speaks for an extended period without yielding the floor, usually in order to prevent Congress from taking action on a measure or a bill. The Kentucky senator's effort highlighted concerns in regard to the Obama administration's domestic drone policy. His filibuster came on the heels of a statement by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder that drones can be used against Americans right here on U.S. soil. Here's a clip of Rand Paul speaking yesterday in the filibuster.
If you're engaged in combat overseas, you don't get due process. But when people say, oh, the battlefields come to America and the battlefields everywhere, the war is limitless in time and scope, be worried, because your rights will not exist if you call America a battlefield for all time. In 1947, the National Security Act was passed and it said the CIA doesn't operate in America. Most people, most lay people know that. The CIA is supposed to be surveillance and otherwise outside the U.S. of foreign threats. The FBI works within the United States. They do some of the same thing, but they're different groups. CIA operating in Iraq or Afghanistan doesn't get a warrant before they do whatever they do to snoop on our enemies. The FBI in our country does. They operate under different rules and for a reason. So we don't want them to operate in the United States. It's not we're saying the CIA are bad people. We just don't want them operating with no rules or with the rules that we allow them to operate overseas. We don't want them operating in our country. The disappointing thing is that a month ago when I asked John Brennan this question as his nomination came forward, he said I couldn't get an answer. He would not answer the question about the CIA operating in the United States. Only after yanking his chain, browbeating him in committee, threatening not to let him out of committee, does he finally say he's going to obey the law. We should be alarmed by that. Alarm bells should go off when we find that what is going on here is it takes that much to say that he's going to obey the law.
That was Senator Rand Paul during yesterday's filibuster. In voting against Brennan's nomination, Paul was joined by Democrats Patrick Leahy of Vermont and Jeff Merkley of Oregon, as well as independent Senator Bernard Sanders of Vermont. Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, who initially opposed the nomination of Brennan, ended up voting in favor both in the committee and in the full Senate vote. At the same time that Rand Paul was preventing a vote on Brennan's confirmation last night, the European Parliament was holding a special session on the targeted assassination program of the United States government. The members announced that the European Parliament will hold hearings next month to look further into the United States targeted assassination program.
In other filibuster news, Republicans in the U.S. Senate are holding up the nomination of a federal appeals judge by using a silent filibuster. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg has more.
I am speaking now with Stephen Spaulding of Common Cause, and I wonder if you could just start by explaining How is the filibuster of the nomination of Caitlin Halligan an example of anti-democratic rule by Senate Republicans?
Well, what we saw with the Halligan filibuster really is an example of an abuse of the rules and of many loopholes in the rules that do not require any senators to actually hold the floor and explain why they are blocking a vote. And ultimately, with her nomination, we saw the Republicans raise the stakes from 51 votes, which is ordinarily required to confirm a nominee, to 60 votes to even open a debate on confirming the nominee. Here we had a bipartisan majority of 51 senators that wanted to move forward and vote on her nomination and provide the president with their constitutionally required advice and consent, but they were blocked from doing so by a minority of 41 senators.
Do you think this is a result of the Tea Party part of the Republican Party trying to obstruct the government from actually engaging in government business?
Well, I think both parties certainly have unclean hands here, but there's no question that the Republicans have really ramped this up. And as we've seen a complete degradation of any form of comity in the Senate, we've seen an increase in partisanship. We've seen senators who are really only here in Washington, D.C. for 3 days a week. So we've really seen a breakdown in the kind of relationships that would have avoided these partisan skirmishes in the past. And unfortunately, it is the case that with the increased polarization, with the increased partisanship, we've seen complete and utter gridlock and chaos in the Senate, and something has to be done to fix the problem so that we can get back to debating the nation's business and where elections can actually have consequences.
So your group then filed a lawsuit. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Common Cause has filed a lawsuit. We've been joined by four members of Congress, including civil rights icon John Lewis, and three DREAM Act plaintiffs. And our point of the suit is to say the Constitution lays out when a supermajority is required. It's required to pass bills. It's required to overturn a presidential veto. It's required to ratify a treaty. That's all laid out in the Constitution when you need more than a majority. Unfortunately, we've seen the Senate rules sort of amend the Constitution in a way to say, actually, you need a supermajority to do anything in the United States Senate. We think that's inconsistent with the Constitution because it clearly lays out a process for legislation to move by majority vote.
And the reason that the DREAM Act plaintiff